Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Summarily, a podcast for busy lawyers. I'm your host, Robert Scavone Jr. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by the president of the Florida Bar, Gary Lesser. Prior to becoming president, Mr. Lesser served on the Florida Bar Board of Governors for 10 years, as the chair of the Florida Bar Legislation Committee, and as the chair of the Professional Ethics Committee. He is a lifelong Floridian born and raised in Palm Beach County, Florida, and he is the managing partner of Lesser, Lesser, Landy & Smith, PLLC. Mr. President, thank you very much for joining me today. I hope all is well.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here with you today. Thanks for the invitation. I was looking forward to being with you and talking with you today.
Thank you. Thank you. So, I was looking through your bio before today's interview, and I can't help but notice the several decades of commitment to the Florida Bar and to the practice of law generally. And I'm wondering where that commitment comes from.
Well, I think it comes in two different ways. Generally, it comes from my father and my grandfather. And my grandfather had started our firm in 1927 as a solo practitioner. I came to West Palm Beach, literally got off the train from Rome, Georgia, and got to work being a lawyer and got to work being involved with the community. He loved being a lawyer. And at a very young age, he filled my head with ideas I still believe in. That lawyers can really help. We can help our clients. We can help our community. And the concept of bar involvement in helping support the independent legal profession and our judicial branch, that came later. But my dad was very much like my grandfather. He would do work for a client and charge them sort of a sliding scale. Some clients didn't pay much at all, but he believed that if someone came to see the lawyer, that they should have the legal service provided and be treated with respect. And I still feel that way. My introduction to bar world really came from my former boss, mentor, and dear friend, Todd Aronowitz, who himself ended up becoming bar president 20 years ago after being on the board of governors for many years. And 25 years ago, now that I think about it, he said, Gary, you should apply for a Florida Bar Committee. You really like being involved with the Palm Beach County Bar. And I chaired the Professionalism Committee and done some other things. And I said, I don't know about that, Todd, the Florida Bar. I'm a Palm Beach County guy, I don't know what this Florida Bar involvement is. And he encouraged me to apply. And I got appointed my first bar committee 24 years ago. I used a phrase the other day when I was speaking with with Justice Kennedy, who I saw in Tallahassee recently. And I said, the bar does invisible work, a lot of work, and not everyone, many people don't know the amount of hours that our 2,000 Florida Bar Committee members spend, in the course of a year, much less Board of Governors and being president-elect or president. But that invisible work protects the independent judicial branch and protects our independent legal profession. And the more I learned and the more I did, the more I wanted to do.
That seamlessly leads me to my next question. You say you've seen how busy people are. I was curious to know how the first few months of your administration have been going and whether or not, obviously as president-elect, you had the opportunity to spend a year sort of seeing how things go. You have a lot of experience with the Florida Bar aside from the president-elect position and your current position as president. But how's it been going so far these first few months? Is it what you thought it would be?
Well, I did a lot of committee work and I did have the year as president-elect, and every president and president-elect have a different relationship based on the people and their relationship with each other. I was really, really, really lucky that my president was Mike Tanner. He came on the board around the same time. We were very good friends. I was respectful of my role as president-elect, which is to watch and learn.
Yeah.
And he had me at the table in a way that many presidents haven't done with their president-elect, and really, helped along my learning curve. Some people become president without that benefit, and they have to do some of their learning curve in the period that 1 year they have to be president. I was very lucky that I kind of hit the ground running. That being said, it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. I'd say it's fair to say it's more work than I thought it would be. And I thought it would be a lot of work, but I'm really enjoying it a great deal. If you're a workaholic and you like to get things done, it's a great job.
And how is the president-president-elect relationship going right now with you and Scott?
Oh, it's going very well. Because I had that benefit with Mike, you know, I knew that I wanted to have, with Mike Tanner, I wanted to have the same type of relationship to the extent possible with President-elect Scott Westheimer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mike did leadership calls with me every week and Executive Director Josh Doyle. And I do that with Scott and I collaborate with him. It's a very big learning curve. Sitting where I am now, I realize how much I didn't know a year ago.
Yeah.
And I thought there was a great deal I didn't know. It turns out it's more. There's a lot of moving parts. You know, I think there's a conception that being bar president means you like drive all over Florida mm-hmm. and you give speeches. And that's good and important. And I like that. And I like talking to lawyers across the state. Next month, I'm going to do 3 days in the panhandle because all of our circuits should get our time and attention, regardless of how many lawyers there are there. Mm-hmm. But if you really want to roll up your sleeves in the governance aspect, that takes time. If you really want to roll up your sleeves on the policy issues, that takes time. But I've been enjoying the work a lot. And I'm in pretty regular contact with Scott. And I try to stay in regular contact with members of our board of governors. Mm-hmm. And I watched some past presidents do this more than others. And the really good ones were always in touch with their board, speaking with them, you know, what do you hear? What's going on? What do you think of this? And I'm very collaborative, you know, by my nature. I don't think I have the idea in my way is the only way. Maybe my good idea is not a good idea, or maybe my good idea could be a better idea. And so that's kind of how I work.
Well, you know, today I think is a great opportunity to, we want to talk to you about your major initiatives. We also want to talk a little bit about how people can get involved. I've been really fortunate over the past 7 or 8 years to be involved with the bar. I was on the Criminal Procedure Rules Committee for 6 years and loved it. I'm currently on the Code and Evidence Committee and I'm enjoying that. And, you know, I'm sure there are other lawyers who want to get involved, not only with committee work, but other things that the bar is working on. So why don't we talk a little bit about the major initiatives that you have for your administration, for your term? What's top of your list?
No, there's two big heavy lifts. And by the way, thank you for your service. CREC, I think we rules there, that's a big lift. So
CREC, yeah.
Our rules committees are a lot of work, but very, very important. So thank you.
Of course.
Our two big initiatives this year are number one, a mentoring program. Mm-hmm. And then secondarily, a focus on greater access to legal services. The mentoring program is something that I've wanted to do for years. And in fact, I had no intention of becoming bar president when I ran for the Board of Governors 12, almost 13 years ago. I ran against two other lawyers in Palm Beach County, good guys, good lawyers, good leaders. I was happy that I won. And I figured I'd serve for maybe a few years and then give the spot up. This is maybe my third year, I went up to the then president. And I said, you know, I'm really worried about all these people who are graduating law school without jobs and they're on their own. I think we should help them. And, you know, we should have a mentoring program. And the person who was president at the time looked at me and said, hey, Lesser, that's a pretty good idea, but I'm not doing that. You want to do that? Go be bar president one day. And I looked at this, well, maybe I will. And then I noticed that there were some bar presidents who really were trying to leave an impact beyond their term of office. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. So this is something I've wanted to do for years. You know, Mike Tanner, when he was president and I was president-elect, gave me some real estate. We were getting, you know, research, getting data, seeing what voluntary bars do. There are some states that have a voluntary and mandatory mentorship programs.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know any of that. I just kind of thought I had this idea. I knew who I wanted to be my co-chairs, Catherine Hurst Miller and Zach Zeros, both, you know, former presidents of the Young Lawyers Division. Both have been regional voluntary bar presidents and just great lawyers and great leaders. And I knew that before I even raised my hand to become president, had reached out to them ahead of time. And we started collaborating. And the more we learned, the more we realized it's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
The Special Committee on Mentoring had its first meeting in June 27. Virtual because it's lawyers from all over the state. I appeared and spoke. Chief Justice Muniz appeared and spoke, and the court's enthusiastic about it. I think it's a good idea because it is a good idea in two ways. When you think about it, you know, the bar is aware that these law school students are graduating and they're either going out on their own and throwing up a shingle, which is fine. A lot of lawyers do that. Or they go to work with a friend of theirs that graduated a year or maybe two earlier, and that's also fine, but they're on their own. And they don't even realize now to the degree to which they're on their own. They have a website, they think they're great shape, and they don't know, you know, what they don't know.
Right.
And we owe it to them to make sure they can be their best lawyers and be their best selves. And it will benefit themselves, their professional growth, and the clients they serve. But secondarily, it's just a great investment. You know, professionalism is what we talk about. And there's professionalism challenges with certainly older or more experienced lawyers and younger lawyers. But we can tackle that head on with the newer lawyers. I mean, what's the best way you learn? I mean, from a mentor. I think everyone who I've spoken with so far, I'll say, hey, can you think of someone in the course of your legal career or your life where you had a mentor who gave you some guidance? Maybe it's one or two meetings. Maybe it's something that lasted a few years. So that's why I know it will be impactful and helpful.
Yeah. It's, as you mentioned, I mean, it's so critical now. There, you know, I would never have thought about hanging my own shingle out of law school. I tell my friends all the time, I would have been a walking malpractice suit. So, you know, and I applaud the people who do that. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of effort, and a lot of hard work. But, you know, as you mentioned, with the, you know, for whatever reason, when the job markets are not great and more people go out there and hang their own shingle, they got to have somebody they can rely upon, not only for professionalism advice, but just your day to day. You know, how do you deal with a client? How do you interact with a client? How do you interact with opposing counsel? You know, how do I file a complaint? You know, there are so many things, like you said, you don't know what you don't know when you start. It's critically important. And, you know, I know I've had a number of mentors through my career and still do. I don't think you ever get too old or too experienced to have a mentor. What are some of the things that you envision this mentorship program doing? And, you know, can you describe maybe a little bit what the mentee-mentor relationship will be like?
Yeah. So when I joined my dad, after he joined his dad, I soon learned there were no clients and no revenue. So I had the privilege of practicing with my dad, and he always gave great life advice. I was kind of on my own, and I sought out mentorship. I approached very experienced personal injury lawyers, because that's what I'd done in law school, and said, you know, how do you do a medical malpractice case? How do you do these complicated cases? Of course, my mentor, Todd Aronovitz, has been my mentor throughout my chunk of my career. Now, we're very close friends, and we have tried cases together. But I had my own experiences personally, and then what I saw elsewhere with friends. But when we really saw what other voluntary bars in the States were doing, that's when we started to really focus. And we realized, number one, we needed a curriculum, an actual curriculum. Most voluntary bar programs fail to some degree. You can just admit that. They fail on the mentor side, because the mentor says, when they're talking to this newer lawyer, well, in my day, when I was a new lawyer and I walked uphill in the snow, and the courthouse had no heat. Newer lawyers don't want to hear these war stories. We like them, but that's about it. You know, they want to actually be heard about what they're doing, what they're experiencing. And new lawyers drop off because they get into this program hoping to meet someone important and get some work. And whatever that general expectation was, when it doesn't happen, they drop. So first and foremost, we're going to explain very clearly what the program is about and the benefits to the mentor and the mentee. You know, the mentors will learn a few things, I suspect. And we're going to focus in the areas of ethics and professionalism. How do you respond to a mean email? The answer isn't a meaner email. Right. We're going to talk about, to your point, about drafting complaint, substantive law. And we're going to talk about the path of your career, the path of a new lawyer. The co-chairs are already starting to come up with a series of milestones, meaning actual agenda items in these different areas. You know, I set the very ambitious agenda to get this program built out by December. Only in bar world is a year considered a normal period of time to do something.
Yeah.
And I said, let's do it in 6 months. Mm-hmm. And so we're building out those programs and that curriculum. And I think that will be helpful if we're trying to especially recruit newer lawyers. We want them to see this is real, this is substantive, and this will help them. And to the last part of your question, the key word that you used, you said the mentor-mentee relationship. It has to be a relationship. Mm-hmm. If it's just this obligation where every month or so you have to do a check-in, well, who wants to do that? I mean, nobody. And, you know, they're actually using an app and to look at different ways of screening for the match of the mentor-mentee. That's going to be really, really super important.
Yeah.
What is your priority? Is it geography? Is it practice area? And so we're going to be very meaningful with the matches, because the goal is when this mentorship is over, the relationship is not, and it continues. And this will become someone that you really rely on and that you want to talk to. And that's both ways. So the goal is to build a meaningful relationship where information can be exchanged and discussed.
Yeah, that the matching component is really important. I remember when I was in law school and after law school, we would have mentoring programs where alumni and current students would get together. And the way we structured it was, you know, in the application, to the best we could, we tried to match people up with, as you said, geography and practice area, so that there is some commonality amongst the mentor and mentee. With respect to achievements, are there going to be, and I know that there really shouldn't have to be incentives worked into these things, but unfortunately, I think when there are incentives, it does help to keep people engaged. Will there be any milestones in the sense that, you know, CLE credit for participating with mentors, or any sorts of, you know, certificates that you get after you complete various stages of the mentor mentorship program?
No, that's you're spot on. So we are going to make clear the requirements of attendance and participation and the benefits of doing so. And what we have discussed is at the completion of your mentorship, A, you'll get a certificate from the Florida Supreme Court.
Wow.
Some type of very official and or some other very official recognition. We're going to do something at annual convention. And this is something that people are going to want to put on the resumes, because it's going to be significant and helpful.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's great. If you know, if you have something like that, as you said, you know, when you're out in the job market, to say that, you know, I've been with X mentor for the past 3 years and I've learned X, Y, and Z, I think that's invaluable. With respect to the mentees, once they graduate, will they be given any sort of priority to become mentors? Is there a number of years that you have to be in practice to be a mentor?
Yeah, so two things. I did forget to mention that we're also looking at CLEs for mentors who participate.
Mm-hmm.
The mentees will already be getting their CLE from the basic skills requirement, but we're looking at that as well. In terms of the length of years to in practice to become a mentor, that's something the committee is talking about.
Mm.
The committee itself is a panel of superstars, lawyers who've been involved in mentorship issues for years. And so I'm doing my best at being hands-off and checking in and offering my thoughts and letting the process go organically. There have been thoughts that you should be a lawyer for 5 years or 7 years before you can become a mentor. We haven't really settled on that yet. But the idea of giving someone priority, having participated in the program, is actually something I'm going to pass on to the committee. Because the goal is, if you participated in this mentorship program and you've worked with a mentor, you personally and professionally have ended up somewhere further than you were a year ago.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll be ahead of the game.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you want to, your hope is to have this in place by December?
Well, the program will be built out by December.
Uh-huh.
We will start pushing it out in the beginning of the year, mm-hmm. in terms of saying, here's the program, and pushing out applications to become mentors and mentees, which we would have to be vetted. Then we will accept people, we will match them. And now we're at March, April, May. And the committee's talking about whether or not to start in May, June, or just wait until August, September, until summer is over and make it a September to June thing.
Okay.
I understand why that makes sense. I wanted like more time and I want to get this thing going.
Yeah.
But if we start over the summer and the mentor mentee are missing each other as a summer plans, that's not a great way to start. So they sort of convinced me there.
Right. So
that might be a better way to go.
So ideally lawyers that should be looking in their inboxes in sometime in the first quarter of next year for some information about how you can apply, how you can get involved in this great program?
Yeah, we're going to do a very big push, and we're going to have to, especially in terms of getting the mentees. So at the beginning of the year, you're going to see a lot of here's what the program is, and this is what it's for. The application process and news about that will probably be more like February, March, and then we'll try to round it up by May-ish in terms of the appointments and the matches and the connections, and then the program would start in September. We're trying to think of what can we do in the interim, right? Because if the summer is sort of a dead time, we don't want to line everything up and then see in 2 months. So we're trying to figure out how we fill in that hole of summer where it's felt that it might not be the most opportune way for mentors and mentees to speak with each other.
Great. All right. Well, that sounds great. And we'll all be on the lookout for that. You mentioned at the top that the second initiative has to do with an access to justice program. Can you give a little bit of background about that?
There's a lot of background. I'll give the concise version. The issue of access to justice or access to legal services isn't a Florida issue. It's a national issue. And it's not a new issue. As you know, it's a decades-long issue. It's just become very, very severe. So a couple of years ago, or a little bit more actually, former Bar President John Stewart got a committee appointed. It was a court committee for greater access to justice. And that committee issued a number of recommendations that many people consider controversial, including non-lawyer ownership of law firms, sharing fees with non-lawyers. I understand the purpose of this special committee was for more affordable, accessible legal services. There's no data, no actual data that demonstrates that bringing non-lawyers into the game makes it more affordable in the market. There's no data.
If I remember correctly, that was one of the Supreme Court's critiques of the non-lawyer ownership proposal, was that there was no data to support that having non-lawyer ownership would add to access to justice. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the Board of Governors had Chair John Stewart come and speak and present two regular meetings and then a special meeting. And we studied all the issues of the recommendations. And we as a Board of Governors last year voted unanimously against those recommendations and sent that with a letter to the court. And so the court then wrote a letter to the Florida Bar saying, all right, what can you come up with, Florida Bar, in terms of ideas that will increase access to legal services? And in April, then President Michael Tanner and I appointed the Special Committee on Greater Access to Legal Services. We're focusing on three buckets. You know, you can't wave a magic wand and solve a decades long problem with the report. And I think previous attempts, other than the whole, let's bring the lawyers in and test the market with no data, other than that, most of the efforts have spent a lot of their time studying the problem. And studying the problem from 30,000 feet. That's not where the problem is. The problem is in the trenches with everyday people who are choosing to not hire lawyers, either because they don't recognize it as a legal problem, they think it's a life problem, or the large number of people think they can't afford a lawyer, whether or not that's true or not. It's increasingly the case. So we're focusing on pro se, pro bono, and the umbrella issue of affordable legal services. You know, Texas, for example, is a pro bono court. You know, many states that don't take that approach have their courts clogged by probate pro se litigants who may indeed have a very valid claim and they don't know how to get it heard.
Right.
You know, you might have seen the report that just came from the Florida Supreme Court work group on sham and vexatious litigation. And the data about some small number of pro se litigants who file the same case again and again and again and again, and it clogs up the system. It's time and man hours to deal with that. So they came up with some recommendations to minimize that. But we think a pro se court might be a good idea. Some jurisdictions have court navigators, non-lawyers saying, what is your issue? Well, this is your form. Not giving any legal advice. You know, President Tanner had the idea for an online platform for low value dispute resolutions. Initially, he was looking at $1,000 or less. No lawyer is going to do that case.
Right.
And maybe even $5,000. So that program is built out and we're trying to see where it can go. Ironically, they have that in England. It's like Her Majesty's Online, or I guess now His Majesty's Online. In the world of pro bono and legal aid, you know, the biggest challenge they have is inadequate resources. Mm-hmm. They don't have enough money to fund the programs they want, and they can't hire enough people. One of the solutions that we're really going to be pushing hard is increased usage of certified legal interns, which normally happens at the state attorney and public defender's office. Now, the way the rule is written, you can be a certified legal intern anywhere. But this requires cooperation from the nominal employer and the law school, and bodies and organizations that aren't familiar with this aren't doing it. So we want to really put, imagine if every legal aid organization in Florida picked up one or two certified legal interns.
Sure.
That's a massive combined impact.
And there are plenty of law students to go around.
Yeah. And you know, there have been previous proposals. If you graduate law school, you haven't passed the bar, you can be a CLI. How can we get people, not quite yet lawyers, certified legal interns, helping people who otherwise might not get the help they need in the world of pro bono and legal aid? The biggest lift is affordable legal services. You know, the belief that, well, I can't afford a lawyer. I think the data is 80% of lower income don't hire a lawyer, and up to 60% of the middle class don't hire a lawyer because they think they can't afford one. And whether or not that's true doesn't matter. Now, I think there is definitely a perception problem, and I've heard this before. You only get a lawyer if you're rich or you're injured. And that's terrible. You know, and I mentioned my dad and my grandfather, they represented regular people who needed help. And that's what we need to really focus on. Not everyone works at the big firms, you know? And if you're on your own, like I was for many years, I did door law. I learned a great deal. I learned how to do real estate closings. I did wills. I'm a litigator. It's kind of what I end up having to do. But the education I got as a lawyer and as a person was invaluable. I think it would be helpful and beyond the scope of the special committee if law schools focused on how to be a lawyer. You know, law school education hasn't changed that much. And my daughter's in law school. And it occurs to me that law school education has changed very little from my daughter back to my father, which is really a crazy notion when you think about it. 60 years difference in time. Why law schools should be teaching practical skills course, how to run a law firm, how to service regular clients. You know, the only major trade or profession that has no internship requirement, no apprenticeship requirement. Long-term, I think that has to change.
Absolutely. You know, Justice LaBarga and Scott Richardson were recently on the program, and we talked a little bit about this particular topic of law schools really not having adapted to the change in the legal profession. You know, I have my own thoughts about it. I think that, you know, law schools for the most part are run and governed by law professors who, you know, have spent their life in academia for the most part and have not practiced law. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing, because we need academics in the legal education field. But I wonder whether or not there's an internal tension in law schools where they recognize this push for more practical and substantive experience while a person is in law school, but yet they really don't have the professionals who can give the practical experience. Because you've got an evidence professor who's never been in a courtroom. And, you know, it's great to teach doctrine, but when you're on the ground, it's a lot different. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, whether there is this sort of internal tension and maybe there needs to be a big shift in the way law schools look at who they hire as professors.
You know, this is me, Gary Lesser, talking, not Gary Lesser's bar president, because this is above my pay grade in terms of my lane and what I do in working with the courts. But somebody's going to have to give one way or the other. We are where we're at to some degree with a crisis. It's a crisis of lack of affordable legal services. We have a crisis with so many lawyers out on their own. I think you actually can put those two things together if the effort is made. And so something's going to give. Either law schools are going to continue the way they've always been, and external factors are going to come in. and affect the legal profession in a way that will make law schools have to change their game. I think what I hope is there's going to be a law school of some repute that says, you know what, we need a practical skills course, and we are going to be the person. We're going to be not the person. We're going to be the law school that is the innovator, and we're going to do this, and we're going to offer a class. And oh my goodness, the class is full, and we're going to offer this every semester.
Yeah.
And then other law schools will follow. You know, their law school. I remember the first time they started doing not mock trial, lit skills, litigation skills, and they could video you doing mock trial. No one had ever done that before. So there were my hope and belief is that law schools will adapt and make change, or changes will be forced on the law schools. And that if a law school takes that step and embraces it, others will follow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the market approach, you know, in the sense that the market will at some point force law schools to make changes. It just seems, I would say slow going, but it seems reverse, because I can remember 10 or 12 years ago that a handful of law schools had come with this idea of 2 years of doctrinal education and then 1 year of practical education for your final year. And it seemed like there was some momentum growing for that sort of approach, but I don't know of any law school. I mean, I don't follow every law school in the country, but I don't know of any of law schools in Florida that have made that transition. Are you aware of any schools in the nation that have gone to that 2+1 sort of approach?
No. And, you know, I do plan on speaking to every dean of every law school in Florida during my year as president and see who wants to give it their best effort. I think current accreditation by the American Bar Association will prevent that from happening as it currently is. I'd love to see the American Bar Association be a leader on this. You know, I always tell people when I speak on this topic that President Barack Obama and Governor Ron DeSantis have said exactly the same thing on this point, which is that we need a mandatory internship. Mm. And if President Obama and Governor DeSantis agree on that one thing, with clarity and detail, by the way, then that thing needs to happen. And both Governor DeSantis and President Obama have spoken at length on this, that third year of law school, you don't need that third year of law school.
Right.
And that part of that time, or the entirety of the time, 6 months or a year, can really be spent more productively helping the lawyer's growth.
Yeah.
And I think that will happen.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, you know, you mentioned the market approach. I mean, I would assume that law firms would love that. You know, law firms would like nothing more than to have a new associate come in who knows the basics and, you know, doesn't have to have their hand held from day one, and that, you know, they can start taking on more substantive work a little bit sooner. You know, so I would assume that law schools would be all for it too. Has there ever been any talk or discussion about if it went to a 2+1 academic approach, that there would be some way to, I don't know if augment or change the actual bar exam would be part of that, in the sense that if you demonstrate over 1 year of practical work that you're proficient in certain areas, that maybe those areas wouldn't be tested on the bar?
It's a tough question to answer. I mean, I can't even imagine that right now, because we're so far away from the underlying condition happening.
Yeah.
The Florida Board of Bar Examiners, as you know, determines who will get the nod from the court to practice law. I think the change would have to come from law schools with ABA consent. But I will tell you something to circle back on the three buckets. We talked about pro se and pro bono, this big umbrella of like affordable legal services. This is the very notion that people don't hire a lawyer because they think they can't. And they're pretty sure. And they approach a landlord-tenant problem or a wrongful termination problem, you know, as a problem with my landlord or my boss, and I don't have a lawyer problem, legal problem, I have a life problem, I go talk to someone in my life, you know, my mom or my friend, who may not actually give the best legal advice. So the bar is launching a public education program called Life Legal Moments, because sometimes in your life, you do need a lawyer to have a properly executed will. When you make your biggest investment of your life and you buy a home, to not spend a smaller amount of money when you're spending you know, 1,000 times that amount on a piece of home, piece of property you're going to own for many years.
Right.
No, and what's happening is that no one's reviewing the contract. People are losing money. Mm-hmm. No one's reviewing the closing statement. People are losing money. And I've had people tell me, people who I know, say, oh, it's okay. The title agent was there. So the title agent has no duty to you. People are surprised to hear that. So the public education program, which will be public facing with regular, you know, journalism, social media, banner ads, a landing page, very short informative videos on why you need a lawyer sometimes. Sometimes you don't, and that's fine. But the court has a great DIY project they've been trying to get off the ground. So that will launch in November, and that will be helpful. And that sort of has merged with the special committee and its efforts. One thing that the special committee is looking at is prepaid legal service plans.
And I'm
familiar you are with that, but at our last meeting at the end of July, we had the two co-chairs of our special committee on greater access to legal services, Jay Kim and Wayne Lewis Smith, make a presentation. And then I did something that I haven't seen done before, though I'm sure it happened, just less formally. We just don't vote. We're supposed to be a policy board. And so we had a whole discussion. We have a special committee, but the two co-chairs made a presentation. And we opened up for questions and ideas. It was really productive. So much so that we're going to do that in our September meeting on mentoring. But I raised my hand and said, I have a question. Who here has ever been an attorney through a prepaid legal service plan? And I said, just me. Hmm. So I realized pretty quickly that, like, we don't have any clients and I don't have any money, and I had six figures of student debt, and I didn't make any money my first year. And through my second year, the same thing was happening. I told my brand new wife, I said, Jennifer, I think you bet on the wrong horse here. I just thought my career was over before it started. And then I heard of this thing to American Express. And so we signed up and you get paid. It's a great, great solution. And it was actually designed to have affordable legal services. It's I want to say rule 9 of our Florida bar rules, but I can double check that for you. And it was designed a while ago. So I would get paid a capitation rate for everyone in my service area that was a plan member, like an HMO. And then a prepaid legal service plan lawyer, yeah, they do some work for free. They'll do a free will, they do a free consult or free letter on an issue. And then they can do supplemental services at a very low hourly rate. But if you're a lawyer with no revenue, it's a pretty good hourly rate.
Right.
And if you are a member of the public who otherwise isn't going to be able to talk to a lawyer, it's a pretty good deal too. So in addition to just publicizing that this exists, because people don't know it exists at all, it was built for this very reason. We're also looking at the rule as it's currently written to make it more accessible. Like, how do you become a prepaid legal service plan? Right now, there's two major providers in Florida. Is there another way to have that model? So lawyers can get in and members of the public can hire lawyers for a reasonable rate. And so that's really going to be, I think, the biggest lift of that subcommittee. And our work is due by the court by the end of December. I have to let you know that the special committee, when Mike Tanner and I called everyone, we split up the list, we pointed them together. And like, thank you, Gary. Thank you, Mike, for appointing me. This is great work. I'm really excited about it. They meet essentially every week. The special committee meets every other week and the subcommittees meet every intervening week. Wow. So they are getting data on all these issues at the same time while trying to start crafting solutions. It's a massive lift. It's the most work I've ever seen any committee do. And all my years of involvement at the Florida Bar. Now, the mentoring committee is a close second, but they have a direction and a goal. The Special Committee on Greater Access to Legal Services is trying to figure out what is really the landscape, what can we do, what data is available all at the same time. And they're working super hard.
Right.
But keep your eye on the prepaid legal service plan. That's going to be something we really expand.
Absolutely. I appreciate the time that you spent with me today. I did want to I did want to ask you one final question before you go. You've got about 3/4 of your term left. you know, then you'll, I'm sure you'll still be involved in some way with Florida Bar. You've been involved with it almost your entire career. What do you see the next 5 to 10 years like in legal practice? What do you see, you know, obviously the access to justice is a problem. What do you see as big momentous things that are coming down the road that people, that lawyers should be thinking about?
Well, you know, it's funny. I thought when I was in Tallahassee yesterday, I flew in Sunday night and then had meetings. We had a reporters workshop yesterday where
I saw the social media presence was big on that.
It's amazing. The bar started it and the court partners with us now, the Florida Supreme Court, and we bring in reporters and we talk with them about how to report on court issues and legal issues like it's not a sporting event. And the reporters who have come are so smart and so thoughtful. You know, I left that program like feeling just very energized, like they're good people trying to do the right thing. But I'm done, and I realize I'm 3 months in, which is like this.
Yeah,
it's the second.
Yeah.
And everyone tells you that, right? That time will go by quickly. So my goal is to get to stick the landing, so to speak, on the work of these special committees. And when you're not bar president, you know, you have to kind of fade away from bar world in the sense that there can only be one bar president. And I want Scott to have that space to do his job. To the extent the court continues to work on these issues, I'd like to stay involved on these issues, especially the access issue. It became like the cool kid thing. Let's have non-lawyer ownership. Let's have a regulatory sandbox. And these are all cool terms, and we sound very smart when we say them. But it's literally, you know, Faulkner's quote of Shakespeare, all sound and fury signifying nothing. But when you talk to people who are true believers and they're futurists, just like the same people who thought we should have reciprocity, every lawyer should be able to practice law in every state. And maybe one day that will happen. That's not today or tomorrow or 2 or 10 years from now, because the laws of the state are very different. And Florida's legal marketplace is different than North Dakota. The people who really believe in non-lawyer ownership, some of them are motivated because there's financial opportunity, but some of them really believe that they see the future that other people don't see, regardless of there being no data. And I consider non-lawyer ownership to be a clear and present danger. I'm not trying to be dramatic to the independent legal profession as we know it. Because once some company comes in and owns law firms, these regulatory sandboxes don't have a very clear model on how exactly they'll be regulated, because these temporary entities are just temporary entities. They just have a license. That's how the programs are working in Arizona and Utah. But what are we doing? Where are we going with this? You know? And so if my law firm gets bought out by, you know, Target Law or Walmart Law, who regulates the non-lawyer owners? Well, theoretically the court, but how? Target doesn't take an oath. They have none of the professional responsibilities. And that very basis of the attorney-client relationship, trust and wisdom, are now for sale. And that is the end of the independent legal profession. And so there's still a rumblings. I'm not very involved with the American Bar Association. They had a meeting, I think, last month, and there was a proposal to sort of covertly push non-lawyer ownership under a different banner, and that got defeated. So that is a very big issue. I was very concerned that the issue was going to gain momentum. Arizona, Utah, California was studying it. Washington studied it. Their programs have not been successful. So I'm hopeful that lawyers can look within the profession and figure out how to increase access and how to help newer lawyers. I mean, those are the issues. I don't think they're going to change. If we don't have a career path that is better mapped out for our newer lawyers on day one, many of these problems are not going to change. Lawyers on their own, not getting hired by clients. They all want to make big money and have a great website. So I think if we focus on the beginning years of a lawyer's career, and again, beyond the Florida bar's lane, but I think law school education must change in the ways that we've been talking about. In addition to, you know, how to be a lawyer and practical skills like that, Governor DeSantis earlier this year signed the Financial Literacy Act, which the business law section pushed for 9 years. It's a simple requirement. You have to have a credit in financial literacy to be able to graduate high school. It's huge. People who graduate high school don't know how to make change. They don't know how to write a check. And that is going to change in the long term. But I think lawyers should have a literacy act. There should be some basic training on what a law firm looks like. What does a public defender's office or government lawyer's office, just from general perspectives, because obviously a public defender's office in Miami would be different than Sarasota. How does it work to be a lawyer? What is a trust account? And these are things that we should be teaching law school students. Now, if I had to take international tax, which I've never used, then perhaps that time might have been better spent on a course that would help me and other people actually practice law.
Yeah, I know my alma mater, FIU, had a law firm program. Mm-hmm. I believe a medical malpractice attorney by the name of Jorge Silva, I believe, used to teach it. I don't know whether they still have it. It was a very popular course. And it was essentially, you know, a business course for lawyers. He would bring in accountants to guest speak and talk about balance sheets and, you know, profits and losses and things like that. Yeah, to have something like that as a mandatory part of the curriculum probably makes sense. I did just want to circle back real quick to the non-ownership, the non-lawyer ownership issue. How have other jurisdictions proposed regulating the non-lawyers?
We don't have sufficient time to answer the question, but I'll give you the short version. It's very unclear. It's very unclear. Basically, entities that they're trying to create in the jurisdictions that are experimenting are given a license. And the license goes to an entity which is regulated by either the court, depending on which state, or the entity that's issuing the license. It's a provisional license, meaning that it can be taken away. There are reporting requirements that are somewhat detailed in order to maintain your license. And they're trying to get data. But this has been the case for 1, 2, 3, 4 years or more, depending on the jurisdiction. There's no data. The entities that have moved in are in the personal injury area. Settlement advance companies seem very interested in being involved in owning law firms. None of the players that have emerged so far have done anything to lower the cost of legal services or make it more accessible. So that's my shorter answer to the question. And they're currently regulated with their special license. But because they're so closely watched and they're so small in number, you know, there's really not much they can do without being under the very watchful eye, because it is literally a laboratory in that sense.
Right.
At grand scale, it could never work at all.
Well, Mr. President, thank you very much for coming on today and speaking with me for a little while. I know you have a very busy schedule, so I'm appreciative of your time. Before you go, tell the listeners, how can they get involved if they want to get involved? What's the best way for them to do that?
Excellent. So I don't want to end on a downer.
No.
By the way, I firmly believe in the independent legal profession. That's what motivates my Florida Bar involvement. And at the Florida Bar, we have come up with many ideas that have faced challenges. We were ahead of the game with mental health issues. The court was a national leader on adapting to COVID. And it was the bar's great honor to work with them and come up with resources. So I'm a big believer that we have the ability to, you know, Mike Tanner and I always like to say, you know, move the needle. It's a phrase he and I use so many times. And former President Gene Pettis said, you know, Gary, how about move the ball 10 yards down the field? And it's so appropriate because we have big challenges in the law, but with everything. Yeah. And there's not a Hail Mary pass for 80 yards on every play. Just move the ball down the field 10 yards and we will make progress. I really firmly believe that. There are a number of ways to get involved and a number of ways to reach me. If you'd like to be more involved, I am very reachable on Facebook. The name of the president of the account is called Florida Bar President. And it's on Facebook and it's on Twitter and it's on LinkedIn. My email is glesser@lesserlawfirm.com. I said that when I was going to run for bar president, it seems like 20 years ago, that I would always be accessible and available. And I still do mean that. My official Florida Bar email is president at floridabar.org. The Facebook page is facebook.com/FLBarPresident. And my Twitter handle, because now I'm on Twitter, is @FLBarPresident. And one more thing I'd kind of like to leave you with is the committee appointment process will start later this year. And President-elect Scott Westheimer will be making a lot of appointments. I think they usually send out the first emails to the Florida Bar members in early December, and then it cuts off in the middle of January. So I would tell every Florida lawyer to look for those emails. Once those emails go out, the Florida Bar typically puts on their homepage a link to apply for Florida Bar committees. And you can choose a first, second, and third option. My decision to listen to my mentor, Todd Aronitz's advice, and get involved with the Florida Bar, man, never could imagine I'd be Florida Bar president. But I've done a lot of rewarding work. I met some really, really good people. When I did my appointments, I actually went to Tallahassee and stayed there for a week. You know, we have 2,000 Florida Bar committee positions, and about 1,100 need to be filled every year. And I had over 1.5 times that number. And I took a lot of time to make those appointments. And I know that Scott Westheimer will do the same. So I'd encourage people to definitely apply for Florida Bar committees and get involved. I am going all over the state. It's a state tour with no music, just talking about Florida Bar issues. And my schedule is online at the Florida Bar. This week, I actually got to go to the Palm Beach County Bar Association, which is a treat to be speaking in my own neighborhood. But I'll be in Tallahassee, November 1. I'll be doing a week in the Panhandle the week before that. And I'm enjoying the work.
Great. And racking up the frequent flyer miles.
A lot of driving.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining me. I will make sure to put as many of those Twitter handles and emails in the show notes so people can find you.
Well, excellent. Listen, I enjoyed our time together, and I will look to speak with you soon. And thanks again for having me on your podcast. I appreciate it.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you for coming. And I enjoyed the time as well. Thank you for your service and for all that you do.
Thanks.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. I want to thank President Lesser for joining me today. I will link as many of his handles and emails in the show notes as I can so you can access him if you want to get involved with the Florida Bar. I want to thank my friend Chris Clark of Pendulum Productions for editing and producing Summarily. You can find him and his work at vimeo.com/PendulumProductionsLLC. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. Please subscribe and share the podcast. And remember, folks, case law is one word.